Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
In association with the faster than ever Boyle Sports app for exclusive price enhancements on the biggest games around. Download it now. Boyle Sports. Time to play.
I'm prepared to anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
So, busy football show coming up for you. We will briefly reflect on some of the Ireland-USA business from the weekend. Dan McDonald was there. Andy's here in the studio. Hello.
Hi, Joe.
We will be checking in on Germany's progress ahead of the World Cup. I think it caught a lot of people's eye when Sané was left out of the squad.
Yeah,
when Sané is not in your best 23 footballers,
it must be pretty good.
You should be winning the World Cup with your eyes closed, really. And that's one of the themes this evening. And then speaking of Germany, 16 years ago today was one of the things which hit us when we woke up on Twitter, and then we were throwing it out. Lots of people had stories 16 years ago.
Forward it goes again by Kinsella. Quinn heads on. Oh, surely this time for Keane. And Ireland do it! Robbie Keane, in the second minute of stoppage time, has scored the equaliser. Look at these scenes. Just look at these scenes. And you can't say they don't deserve it.
Oh, these scenes, Dan.
Good memories,
magical
Joe.
Moments.
A lot of memories flashing in across the night as well.
Loads. I think people still will do well to beat Enda Carroll.
I think that was a
winner.
Pretty good one. Do you want to run through it again?
Turk's Head lads, loads of us met Bill Clinton and Bono outside a kebab shop. Have we had anyone else verified this, JP? No one else has texted?
Well, I mean, you got Enda, you got Bill Clinton, you got Bono. So, I mean, yeah. I think only one of the three is going to be texting in.
The Holy Trinity. Fair. He says loads of us met Bill Clinton and Bono. So I'm putting Enda's claim
Turk's
to the test.
Head, I think you said. Yeah, I was saying to one of the lads outside that Temple Bar during that World Cup actually was a bit of crack, like, because you'd have all the nationalities knocking around the place.
Well, it should be this time around again, no?
Yeah, I guess so, actually. Yeah, just wouldn't go there.
Bill was staying in Bono's hotel. Don't know how Enda knows this. He obviously had a good chat with Bill.
Obviously.
And shook their hands and followed them around Temple Bar for a bit of singing. And we sang Re-elect Bill, Re-elect Bill. What a day, says Enda. No doubt.
Probably not a great day for Bill or Bono if it did actually happen.
I'd say they loved it. Imagine you're Bill Clinton on the day that, for no obvious reason to you, everybody's incredibly happy and wearing green jerseys and jumping up and down.
Yeah, it's been only 2 years since he was out of office as well, so.
Yeah, myself and two friends, all just out of college, were in the seats behind the goal where Robbie scored. Now, Ronan and Cork.
It's a hell of a memory.
I don't know anyone who was there.
Yeah. Aside from lads who are working, I've spoke to a couple of people who went out there. Right, yeah. I remember the late Carl O'Malley, who passed away a few years ago, Irish Times guy. I remember he definitely went, and I remember around the time he passed away, sort of it suddenly. But I remember seeing pictures and sort of stuff from O2. Like that was a big trip, that him and his mates went on. I think at that stage, so. Yeah, I think it's just it's sort of a story that sort of reveals people's ages, because a lot of the texts in are
leaving cert,
but then obviously the slightly older. I was just slightly older, but then people that were in their early 20s then, as you mentioned, just finished college, maybe for them, that was the trip they could afford. It was the trip that they could do, you know?
Well, Ronan says, myself and two friends, all just out of college, were in the seats behind the goal where Robbie scored. Bedlam. Ended up 10 rows from where I was sitting. No idea how. Stadium was in the middle of nowhere. 2.5 hour train from Tokyo, where everyone was staying. I didn't realise that. And it was dry, no booze. It was about 4 hours after full time at around 1 a.m. that night, where most of us had our first drink. Night went on a bit after that, though, says Ronan Cork. No doubt.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that it was in such an isolated place.
Yeah.
2.5 hours from Tokyo. And Ewan McKenna replied on Twitter, leaving search here. Oh, I mean, that's just cruel. School principal pulled back gym curtains where we were doing our exam. Stuck in a clenched fist, that little yelp that caught a bad look from the supervisor. and then disappeared again. There's lots of principals behaving inappropriately in 2002.
There was another message in there that some fellow said he dropped to pass English so he could get out there early as well. He could finish his exam a bit earlier.
Oh, I mean, well, look, I can't throw stones. I did do transition year to avoid it, but pass English when you could have done honours, I don't know if that's a long-term view.
Yeah, very much so. Very
in a
much
flat
so.
In Dundee, says Greg Campbell, about 30 other Irish lads glued to the TV in between the uni exams. I remember the stat that Robbie Keane and the Brazilian Ronaldo were the only two players to score past Oliver Kahn in that 0-2 World Cup. I suppose that's the other thing to emphasise for younger listeners, Dan. You can't really overstate just how unbeatable Oliver Kahn felt at that time.
He was a monster during that competition. And even in that game, I think there'd been Irish chances earlier on where he was intimidating. Because actually, Jeremy, the run after that and the run even around it wasn't hugely sort of intimidating. But still, you know, he was still a hell of a good goalkeeper.
Yeah, and this Peter Schmeichel-esque dominance.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And even Keane sort of needed to sort of score from a slightly curious angle, like, you know, off the inside of the sort of the post, you know.
It was a weird finish, all right.
Yeah, it's actually strange that if you go through since 2000, like three great Irish goals. Like you've got Shane Long's against Germany, Robbie Keane's against Germany. I say great in terms of, you know, the celebrations and even O'Shea's one in Gelsenkirchen last weekend, but yeah. O'Shea's 100th cap. But fairness, you know, we have some good memories and against the Germans.
The Germans have been good to us, yeah. Andy Hanrahan was teaching first class, brought in a portable telly, washed it with them, missed the goal. I was tidying up a spilt milk carton. It's unfortunate.
No use crying over that.
Hey, damn. Phenomenal. Alan Moore then finally, because we've got to get stuck into some stuff. I was waiting in a garage in Carrickmacross to have my battery replaced. See, this is what I don't understand, right?
Businesses that kept open.
Well, no. If I needed to get my battery replaced in the car, I'd put it off an hour or two that day.
Yeah, that's actually, to be fair.
Anyway.
I wouldn't actually tell that story.
I was waiting in a garage in Carrickmacross to have my battery replaced.
Or maybe it broke down on the way, to be fair. In his defence, he could have been going somewhere and then it just...
The doubt, but not really. The lads asked if I didn't mind waiting until the match was finished. See, they had their priorities in order. The lads working there.
Why were they even open?
Having had to watch Ireland Cameroon in a road stop cafe near Istanbul, a garage in Carrick seemed fitting. Okay, interesting. So just, 5-6 days earlier, he'd been at a road stop cafe near
the
Istanbul.
The Cameroon game, I think, was a Saturday morning.
It was, yeah. That was first thing, 7. I remember, in my state, there were barbecues going on at 7 in the morning.
Really?
It's like a disconcerting thing to smell. Fresh meat being cooked, steaks being cooked and the barbecue.
7 a.m.
Yeah. Hey, listen. So,
why not?
Ireland, USA then. Don't know what to take from this game, really, beyond the obvious. You were there. I missed the first half. I had to watch the hurling, Cork and Limerick, and it was a fairly jolting experience to go from one of the great hurling games
of the year. Here we go. Watching the game, is the hurling's better than this? Come on, you're better than that, Joe.
No, but it was.
You're like a walking internet article there, to be honest.
It was a very jolting experience. To go to any football friendly is near impossible because the pace of the game, the speed of the game is just so different.
Yeah.
It's completely different. So it took me a while to acclimatise. And I was kind of sitting there in a stupor for maybe 10 minutes of the second half. I'd seen the halftime analysis. The general tone of Kenny Cunningham and Kevin Doyle was, well, on the upside, they haven't hurt us. Now, we haven't hurt them either, was the kind of feel.
And I conceded another goal.
They had just scored a goal
piece,
late on, yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah, 3-0.
But it was about 10 minutes, 15 minutes into the second half, trying to reacclimatise to life at this pace after the aforementioned hurling. And it struck me watching in particular, okay, cliche alert again, Declan Rice. But also O'Dowda, I very much liked, and Lenehan,
yeah. And Horgan come on and did well off the bench as well when he was brought in.
Yeah, he didn't catch my eyes much, but he was lively. But I guess I was a bit more into the game when he came on. But I was about 10 minutes into the second half when I thought, actually, we're playing decent stuff here. Like, we're trying to do the right things. We're trying to put passes together. We're trying to pass it forward. There are numbers in the box. And Dave McIntyre made the point the other day that doesn't sound like much in some respects in a friendly against a below-par USA team.
Yeah.
But it's not like we overpower every team that comes there, even lesser teams than us on the possession stakes. So we've had Georgia, you know, boss us.
I think they won on possession stats as much as you can read into that. But I think, it was 56% Irish possession at the weekend. Again, it's not dominance. It's just not being dominated.
For us, it's like about 90%.
That's our 90%.
So was I imagining things? Or did it feel that way in the stadium?
I don't know. Certainly, in the front, Ireland were on the front foot in the second half. I mean, it is true though. Like a friendly is a friendly in the sense that you can't imagine that you would have a competitive game where you'd have an opponent who studied Ireland that maybe would give them as much time as USA did at times. But at the same time, like Rice in particular, because he was the shield or, you know, the most defensively orientated midfielder in the original sort of formation they played, which was sort of 3-5-2, the fact that he was pressed on, you know, he was in the opposition half from his defensive position, suggested that Ireland were doing okay. Now, by the time Ireland got the winning goal, they'd actually changed to four at the back, so the setup was slightly different. But Rice, still your defensive guy, was still in the opposition half. Now, I think some parts of analysis were picked out afterwards, actually in the first half, where maybe he'd actually left a bit of space behind him, a small bit. And you still have the...
Gary Breen did that piece of analysis, did you see that?
Yes.
It was just once or twice he's going out quite enthusiastically to try and win the ball back, maybe on the touchline or out of position slightly. And Breen just highlighted he had completely vacated that centre circle area. And against better teams, they'll spot that very quickly, slip the ball into that area, and you'll be in trouble. But he said... it was such a minor point compared to the overall impact Rice was making effectively in his, third game?
The third game, and although his third cap, he's probably been the best Irish player in all three of them. And also, he made 30 appearances for West Ham this year, but pretty much all of them were, you know, in a defensive role. Mm. So his midfield experience at a good level is mainly under 21 international football. So it's not as if he's, you know, he's played 30 games in the Premier League in midfield. This is easy. Mm. It's still a new enough position, but for him, but it's a sort of his natural confidence and ball retention, but also a bit of ambition with the ball as well. Just to ping a pass that's a bit more positive. You know, I'm not saying he was sort of cutting open defences with through balls, but it was just trying to get things going a bit. And it certainly helped, and it brought other attacking players into the game too, because this is the thing. Declan Rice alone is not going to turn Ireland into a wonderfully creative force that cuts things open at home. But if he can allow maybe some of the more creative players to get on the ball in positions where they can actually hurt teams, then that's what you want your midfielder to do.
Mm. I mean, there's something kind of old school and Paul McGrath-esque about the player who can play centre half.
It's the obvious comparison. It's a very unfair comparison, but it is the one where...
But isn't it brilliant?
Well, you feel he'll play, like he'll be the first name in the team sheet, just and then you figure out the position afterwards. And maybe there was an element of that with McGrath too.
I think we need him in midfield now, watching him. Like Kev Kilbane, one of the few people I do know who was there in 2002.
Yes.
It occurs to me.
Pretty significant part.
God damn him. He bemoaned the fact that quite often the Irish midfielder's instinct will be, okay, standard example, fullback will feed the ball into an Irish midfielder whose first touch will not be to turn out, but will be a heavy-ish first touch back towards the direction of the defender, and then they're being swamped by the opposition, and it has to be played back to the defender, who then is in even more pressure than when he first hit the pass and has to just clip it long. And that too often is the pattern.
Yeah.
He said, watch Rice, and there is a real determination where possible, without taking too many risks, to actually just get turned. And then quite often, he'll dribble forward a little bit.
He'll try.
And slip a pass.
He did that in Turkey even when he went into midfield.
And it's actually that reason I mentioned McGrath, is in, it's quite old school now for modern day midfielders to take a ball, turn, and dribble forward. Like it's all one touch, two touch, two touch, pass it on. But he's kind of like, I'm going to just jaunt forward here and then slip a little pass when I draw a man. And you don't see that very often.
And O'Neill is obsessed with that. I think we touched on a small bit of the pay-per-view on Sunday, but now you're covering O'Neill for a period of time and you talk about Ireland's midfield player being predictable. He always returns to these buzzwords and buzz phrases, and he likes midfielders who he says just really drive on with the ball.
Yeah.
Rather than necessarily trying to pick a pass all the time, a Hollywood ball, just actually, just as you mentioned, try and just take the game a bit. And that's why he also, I think, likes O'Dowda in the middle too.
I thought O'Dowda was very, very
good.
Yeah.
But I mean, you do at the same time, and this is where why you shouldn't get carried away with sort of the friendly success. But then again, they're also relatively inexperienced players at this level, so you have to cut them a bit of slack too. And it may well turn out that like France was a very high standard of opponent. I mean, France went and also gave Italy a hell of a going over the weekend as well. But watching back a bit of the France game, there was one moment actually where Rice was really positive, but under the cosh, passed the ball to O'Dowda, who tried a little flick and gave the ball away. There was a couple of times O'Dowda in the first half in that game. You're thinking, if you're playing a better side and O'Dowda and that midfielder are going to be really on the defensive. Is that necessarily his game to be one of the three in that setup? But I can see why he likes his positivity to try and get the team forward and out of trouble. And you know, we'll see what system he's going to go for in the longer term. You know, where would he play O'Dowda if he went for the four and the, you know, four at the back? Is he still just going to be a winger ultimately? He's played him left of a diamond before as well. There's a few things he can do with him, but I think either way, to go back to the original point, I mean, Rice plays in all these permutations.
Some quotes on O'Dowda from O'Neill, and it's interesting you just mentioned the drive forward thing. He can drive forward with the ball.
Sorry, I did not know that was coming.
No, it's all right. That is a line. Verifies your point. He says, I've a lot of time for Callum, and I think he's got a lot of natural talent. He needs a lot of encouragement.
Well, he is one player, O'Dowda, that you have to say, like, he was playing in League Two initially when he was brought up to train with the squad before the Euros. That you could make the point about O'Neill sometimes that he's been a bit reactive to player circumstances at club level. Even, you know, guys going from here, the whole magic playing theory, then he waits till they get the move before they call them up. Mm. Whereas with O'Dowda, in fairness, saw him play for the under-21s in a game in Waterford.
And we know what he needs a then, lot of encouragement euphemism is about.
Well, no, I think he just suggesting this, you know, in terms of his character, that he feels he's the type of player that needs a bit more belief in himself, possibly.
Okay.
You know, I think that I'm reading between the lines. I mean, O'Dowda, I don't know, you're trying to lean sort of on the pitch. He looks quite confident in terms of stuff he tries, in terms of any press stuff he does. He's very articulate and confident fella. Maybe he's not an imposing, dominant character. Maybe they want to demand stuff of him. But he's certainly one player, you have to say, that there's never been a clamour necessarily for O'Dowda to be picked.
Yeah.
But you know, so he hasn't been reacting to some call for him. It's O'Neill all the time who's just is one player he spotted and kept promoting.
Yeah, well, I think he was good. So on Rice, O'Neill was just glowing in his praise of Rice. And he did it with the Air Sport TV interview. And then you were saying he came into the print section and did something very similar, wanted to really make a point of Rice. He's outstanding. One thing I learned from this match is that Rice is probably the most outstanding player on the pitch.
Yeah.
I'm delighted for him. His ball to James McLean for the goal, he looked up and saw him, and it was like he had played 100 times for his club and 100 international games. It was a brilliant ball. It might have looked quite simple, but it was a really good ball. Some might have tried it with a left foot just to toss it into the area, but he hit it into James with such precision, and that allowed Alan Judge to follow in. Where he plays is another thing, but he was brilliant in midfield. He demanded the ball, he used it. He's a proper talent. I don't know where West Ham think his best position is, and I'm not sure he knows either. And we have some of Declan Rice speaking afterwards to Jamie Moore.
Did you hear the comments from West Ham that they want you to try and, or the new manager, to make into an England international? And what did you make of it?
No, it was just, you know, he was on TalkSport talking, and it's one of them things, you know, he's just come out and said it. I'm not going to take too much by it, you know, he can say that, obviously that's his opinion, but I'm here tonight, I'm playing for Ireland, and, you know, I've just been focused on doing that, playing in the Turkey and France game.
Yeah, the assistant manager Roy Keane spoke to us during the week, and he said he was very surprised with the comments that you're Irish and you're playing for Ireland, which all of us Irish people were happy to hear. You do see yourself as an Irish international, and hopefully once that competitive debut comes, it'll be the end of the question.
Yeah, I think it was off topic, you know, for him to come out and say that. You know, I did hear Roy's interview the other day, but I don't try to think too much about it. You know, I don't want to take too much pressure onto myself or put pressure on myself. I just want to keep playing, enjoying my football and playing with a smile on my face. And I think that's the main thing I've got to do.
I don't think he was going to say much else in that situation. It is kind of funny the way West Ham keep thinking, this lad has a real chance for England now.
Well, it was just David Gold making a casual comment. He didn't seem, you know, Royce then did a bit of stuff with the papers after and basically just described it all as a load of crap, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I think really, let's just chill out here.
Yeah, he's done.
He's round, like, you're sticking around here.
David Gold, Jim White, 23rd of May. I'm looking forward to the new manager turning Declan Rice into a strong England defender for the future of the England team. How can you own a football club and really not know?
well, West Ham.
Well, okay.
Let's go through the recent chronology of West Ham in recent years and say what's, you know, normal about there.
A last point or two in the game, the future for Graham Burke.
Described
by Dave McIntyre as a fine finish.
A well taken
took it,
goal.
Took it very well.
Yeah, I mean,
on Sunday.
That's
we gave him a good slag.
We all bluff on air.
He had seen the goal. He was just
really.
Yeah, he had seen it. Poacher's finish.
Oh, that's just poor judgment. I just thought he was trying to cover the fact he hadn't seen it.
No, he wasn't. He'd seen
highlights. Okay.
I feel bad now that we shouldn't.
No, he's solid pro as well, Dave. Solid pro. But you don't feel that bad. You're actually smiling.
No, I actually. Dave's been misrepresented here. Anyway.
Anyway, let's move on. But yeah, Graham Burke, I mean, will
O'Neill sended a note of caution over Burke?
Yeah, he was conscious of not sort of building him up. And I thought he did fine. Like, he did well, but he wasn't sensational. He didn't look out of place, didn't look overawed. Probably the way the game was played wouldn't suit him. At times, he is the type of player that drops short and looks for the ball. And when he was on the pitch, there was moments where I was going long to Walters and he wasn't really playing off him as a sort of a strike partner. So there was just moments where it didn't quite happen for him, but he still got his goal. Mm. But it was more so his confidence in general play, probably even as much as in Paris, as you know, that I would take away as much as the USA game. And even in Paris, he wasn't fazed by coming on there. And what happens, there's certainly interest from Championship clubs. I know from that even since he played in that game in Celtic, that Rovers have just, they're going to get, you know, they're getting more knowledge of interest. And I mean, his season is ongoing. Like, they play against Bray on Saturday, which is sort of a contrast from playing in the Stade de France. But you can assume there's a lot of clubs looking at him, and there is Championship level from, you know, Brentford, Blackburn, Preston, Nottingham Forest, I think, as well. And they're all going to suss him out over the next while and see if he's a right fit for them, because he is a player that doesn't, he's not a Sean Maguire who's an out-and-out number nine. You need to fit him into a team, so it's just not a straightforward acquisition for people. But at the same time, I mean, you know, the ability is unquestionably there, and I'd expect him to be back at this stage, whether it's in a competitive game later this year or not. But in the future, I don't see any reason why he won't be, because again, it's not as if we have five or six or seven other options to be calling on in that position.
No, it's true. Some other last bits and pieces. Obviously, everybody very happy for Alan Judge. There was a great photo of his dad.
Great story.
His dad being mobbed by family when he scored the goal, and what an amazing relief for all of them. David Myler, it seems, confirmed to Reading. John O'Shea, an imminent move to Reading. And Chris Forrester to Aberdeen,
Peterborough to Aberdeen. That's an interesting one to watch, because he's going to the...
It's the same path as Chris Forrester.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's gone to Peterborough and was flying, played Chelsea in an FA Cup match. He was called in the Provision Ireland squad. Real natural talent. Had a miserable year or so at Peterborough. New managers come in there and tried to clear him out, Steve Evans. But I mean, I think falling out with Steve Evans might be a badge of honour for some players at times. He's a sort of a manager who was a sort of a checkered reputation, particularly with ball playing midfielders. So might be better for Forrester to get out of there. Aberdeen, I mean, he'll be playing in Europe, playing for a top three team in Scotland. Then might be better, not a bad move for him in the long run. He's still got a fair bit of time in his side, and there's no doubt in the talent. But there will be more moves this summer, from McLean to Johnny Walters, maybe to Burke and a few others. I think there is lads that need to probably address their club situation with a view to the Irish thing.
We're going to take a short break. We do want to speak with Jonathan Harding, German football writer with the Times and Deutsche Welle. But just to mention, because I know we'll get to 10 o'clock and I'll be kicking myself because we haven't even just mentioned it.
There's a few stories knocking around.
There's not too much to say about this, but it is interesting if you didn't see it. So it seems like Pearl Karius underwent an examination and scan at Massachusetts General on the 31st of May. So this was 5 days after the Champions League in Kiev. And a statement has been released from the doctors who studied him. Mr. Karius underwent a comprehensive examination by Dr. Ross Savante and Dr. Lenore Herget in Boston at Massachusetts General Hospital and Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. After carefully reviewing game film and integrating a detailed history, including his reported present and immediate post-contact subjective symptoms, physical examination, I shouldn't have read all this, and objective metrics, we have concluded that Mr. Karius sustained a concussion during the match. They say at the time of our evaluation, Karius's principal residual symptoms and objective signs suggested that visual spatial dysfunction existed. That means he didn't know what the hell was going on around him, Dan.
Yeah.
And likely occurred immediately following the event. The event seems to be good old Sergio Ramos throwing that elbow at his head.
Well, he might have been pushed in his direction.
And but of course, and at the exact moment...
Welcome to whataboutery territory here.
At the exact moment that he was pushed, the point of his elbow seemed to rise nicely towards
welcome
the direction.
Welcome to whataboutery territory. No. I mean, this is a serious enough topic that naturally the response to it is a load of garbage chat, depending on whichever side of the thing you stand. I mean, there is possibly no doubt that it's been a good story for Liverpool to get out, you know, and from the point of view of the player and so on, it probably helps in terms of demonisation. However, it's still also a serious subject too, in the sense that, you know, football doesn't really have a hard and fast way of dealing with concussion within game situations like that. I think it was Ross Tucker maybe tweeting about it today, making some interesting points on it, that, you know, if you were to introduce like some kind of mandatory break, you know, you have to guard against people citing concussion as an excuse, you know, to for a delay or to go out. You know, I mean, there's a difficulty in terms of judging it inside games when someone's in a situation. But you've no doubt that this happens all the time.
Yeah, in rugby, they just take it out of the hands of everyone, so it's spotted in this crowd
exactly.
on television, and then they would say Sergio Ramos elbow to carry his head. It's a HIA.
Let's treat this. Yeah, and that's possibly maybe the road that we need to go down.
But yeah, interesting. As you said, it does rehabilitate his reputation somewhat. So
it was probably important to get it out.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, they wouldn't have released it otherwise, I suspect. Let's take a short break and then we'll check in on Germany and how they're shaping up.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Now, you're welcome, Max. So the World Cup is very much upon us and we are discussing Germany. We have German football writer with Deutsche Welle and The Times, Jonathan Harding, on the line. Evening, Jonathan.
Good evening, gents.
Thanks so much for being with us. So Germany, ranked number one in the world, defending champions, have Mexico 15th in the world, Sweden 23rd in the world, and South Korea 61st in the world in their group, and are unquestionably one of the favourites to win the World Cup. How can Sané not be in the squad, though? How can that even happen?
Yeah, I've had to deal with that question quite a lot in the last few days. I think on first viewing, it perhaps looks, you know, quite crazy. Young player of the year in the Premier League, had a fantastic year at Manchester City. Why would he not be in the team? But I think the performances for Manchester City are not the type of performances we've seen him have for Germany, and that's maybe where the decision is a bit more understandable. His positional play on the left wing hasn't quite brought the same brilliance that it has for Manchester City. He hasn't shown defensive awareness the way that Joachim Löw likes his wingers to do so. It's a case of club form not translating into international form, and given the squad being only 23 man big, he had to make some tough decisions. Löw emphasised balance, and that means that there are going to have to be some players that are left out.
And as spoilt as Germany and German football fans are, is there much of an argument in football circles over there that, well, you know, coach him? If Guardiola can get these performances out of him, maybe we should try. Maybe we shouldn't write him off just yet, kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I don't think Löw's writing him off per se. I mean, he did say that he will be back in September after the World Cup, and he'll expect him to take on the next level. We've got to remember he's only 22. There is certainly a degree of coach him, make him better. But in the 12 appearances he's had for Germany so far, there haven't been any signs that he's really progressing in finding himself. Löw did say he hasn't arrived in the Germany team. And that's maybe sort of a tip of the hat towards the fact that the way he plays at Man City isn't being replicated in the Germany shirt. And that's a problem. He can't take a player who's not the same.
Is that the way that the story is sort of being covered in Germany, Jonathan? I know there's also the fact he didn't go to the Confederations Cup last year and had no surgery as well. I mean, is there any niggling sense that there's some element of punishment about that, or that, you know, it's not just about strictly the role he can play, that maybe, you know, others are deemed to be more integrated for every reason?
I think the decision not to play in the Confederations Cup has probably not put him in the best possible position, but I don't think this decision is one that's a punishment of that. Certainly wouldn't have done him any harm to be in that tournament. I mean, take another winger in the squad. Julian Draxler played in that squad, was excellent in that team, captained that team, and basically assured himself of a squad role in by doing so. Sané's decision not to play in that tournament won't have done him any favours, but I don't think he's not in the squad now because he didn't play in the Confederations Cup. I just think he doesn't fit the way that Löw wants his Germany team to play. And as much as that might be hard for Premier League fans to understand, it does make sense in the context of the squad. At least I can understand what he's trying to do with it.
Yeah, we're playing up the negatives here, but really, Germany qualified with 10 wins, no draws, no losses in their group. I mean, it was a record qualification campaign from Germany. They're defending champions. They're ranked number one in the world. They have a coach who's led them to a World Cup previously. I know they're on a 5-match winless streak, but that does include games away to England, France, Spain, Brazil, and admittedly they lost in the last few days to Austria 2-1. I don't know how much stock you put in that, but everything kind of suggests, looking in on the outside, like they're in absolutely exceptional shape. Is that generally the feeling in the country?
I mean, I was fortunate enough to be down there for 5 of the first 6 days when they were in South Tyrol in the training camp, and there's certainly a sense of every single member of that squad is not just there to play a role or be a sub. There's certainly a pushing ambition for everybody to start, which is a good competitive environment to create in the team. There's a lot of self-confidence going into this tournament. There's no reason why not. And whilst it's easy to make a lot of friendly results in the fact they haven't been very good, Germany lose friendlies and do well in tournaments. I think that's kind of the way that it's always been.
I mean, Jonathan, naturally people just check into to major tournaments, check into other international teams sometimes in major tournaments. So in terms of how you might expect this Germany team to sort of set up or in those attacking areas, I mean, for their first game at a competition, what are we looking at in terms of forward options? I know sort of, you know, Timo Werner is the interesting new face, but is it going to be some of the more tried and trusted players then, or how do you sort of see it panning out?
Well, Löw did speak highly of Mario Gomez in terms of his fitness and his shape recently, which I was a little bit surprised at given that he hasn't been fully fit in the last few weeks, but I expect Timo Werner to start the line. Timo Werner is the striker that Joachim Löw has been spending the last 2 years arguably looking for. Given Marco Reus's connection with Löw, I expect him to start left. Mesut Özil is basically the number one name on the team sheet behind Manuel Neuer. So you're looking at Werner, Reus, Özil and Thomas Müller. I mean, the guy's only got 6 more goals before he's level with the all-time World Cup goal scorer. So the front four kind of reads itself, I think.
And what about Löw's Löw's standing in German football? What type of personality is he away from tournaments? Does he do much media? Do people know him well? Would they know about his family? Would they know about his views on things? Is he a private character? What's his general role, I suppose, in German life? Because he's been there for so long now. You think back even to the Klinsmann days, and then obviously he's graduated to the senior position. Like, really, a tenure that long should be incredibly stale. So the perception of Löw, people must know him pretty well at this stage.
I think there's certainly a degree that anybody who wins you the World Cup is someone that you know.
Yeah.
I think he's generally quite a private person. I mean, it's not like he doesn't speak to the media. He does. He's certainly developed a certain role in terms of how to speak to the media. If you compare to when he first arrived, he's a lot more comfortable. The way that he announced the squad and who was leaving the other day was perhaps a little overdramatic. But I don't know whether he's become more of a public figure in terms of what he reveals about himself. I think he's remained quite a private person, but winning the World Cup will do you wonders. And I think everybody in Germany certainly feels closer to him after that win in Brazil.
So, I mean, every time I turn on the television, I have Jurgen Klopp doing an ad for a car or something. Löw is not that character in Germany.
No, he's definitely not. There's definitely a big difference between Jurgen Klopp and Joachim Löw in terms of character. Klopp is very much outgoing, is aware of the type of humour that he has with people and the connection that he forms. Löw is far more private, likes to have that connection with his players and his group. And you can see that in his selection. He's picked players that he knows that he has a strong bond with, even if there are maybe some question marks over why some players were left out or some players were included. If you look at his history of selection, it's based on having a bond and having a strong understanding with what that player can provide him within his system. And he's always been that kind of coach, I think.
And is he the type that will appear in a two-page spread in the Sunday newspaper sometime around now, given things away or chatting comfortably about topics away from football? He's not courting any of that.
No, I don't think he's that type.
Right.
I think if he does do those interviews, then they'll be purely football related. Okay. And you'd have to read quite far between the lines to get anything concrete.
And how does he manage his players? Is he close with them? Is it carrot? Is it stick? Do we know?
It's tricky to know from the outside. I think when we were there in the training camp, you get 15 minutes normally for training, and then most of the interesting work is done behind closed doors. I think that's fairly standard practice. He tends to keep quite a tight angle on his team. I think that's fair enough, but he definitely has very strong personal relationships with some players. I mean, this Manuel Neuer has walked back into this team after 8 months out to be the starting goalie and the captain. That says a lot about his standing in the team. Marco Reus has missed the last two tournaments through injury, and here he is probably going to start on the left wing. That says a lot about their relationship. So I think he's very much a relationship kind of guy, and his selections are based on performance, but also the character and what they can bring to the squad.
You mentioned there about Ozil being the next man on the team sheet after Neuer. Like, what is the perception of Ozil now? Because even when Germany won the World Cup the last time, and I think there have been times when, I mean, his standing, there's been a debate over it, but the way you're speaking, he's sort of acknowledged now maybe by all as a central figure?
It's tricky. I think people appreciate him, but I think he's a bit of a Marmite figure. I think even in Germany, there's certainly a case of, oh, well, You know, we hear it a lot in England, this body language issue, or maybe he disappears in games. I think we come back to that connection with Löw and the understanding that they have with one another. And actually, Mesut Ozil does so much off the ball in terms of his movement and how much play he opens up that you might not notice because you're already looking at the ball or you're distracted by something else in the game. He's such an invaluable member of this team. It's easy to assess him based on how he might look on the pitch, but what he brings to Germany, Löw will always stick by him, I think, for how much he's given and how much he understands about his role in this team. But Germany itself, as a sort of their perception of him, there's still perhaps some people that think he could look a little bit more keen on the football pitch, shall we say?
Yeah.
But he's still capable of producing magic. So,
is this a better German team than 4 years ago when they won the World Cup? Is this seen as an improvement or a team which are hanging on?
I think it's a very good question. I don't think hanging on is an accurate description of this team. I think they have a better strike force than 4 years ago. I think Timo Werner is really an excellent player. The only thing they have to worry about in that sense is if he doesn't score for a couple of games, how's Löw going to manage that? He'll need to manage his confidence well. But I think the midfield looks fairly solid. If you look at Kroos, Khedira, Gundogan, Goretzka, that's very encouraging. Any country would love to have those four midfielders at their disposal. The only question mark is maybe defensive midfield, whether they have enough cover. I think it's a slightly less aging team than 4 years ago. I think that's maybe one way to look at it. Mm. Slightly more peaking in some areas. I think it's a huge tournament for Germany. You're looking at a lot of players that are potentially approaching their final tournaments. Manuel Neuer, Mats Hummels, Jerome Boateng, Sami Khedira, Thomas Müller. These are all players that come into the end of their 20s or already in their early 30s. Have to ask whether they're going to be here in 4 years' time. So there's a certain onus on them to deliver once more. Mm. But it also means that Germany are shifting and Löw is having to bring in new pieces at the same time. So it's quite exciting.
Okay. I suspect somehow we'll be talking to you towards the latter stages of this tournament, one way or another. Jonathan Harding, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Cheers, gents.
Cheers. Jonathan Harding there, a German football writer with Deutsche Welle and The Times. I think they'll be okay one way or another. I think they'll be semi-finals
they'll
minimum.
Struggle on through. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is quite interesting that they are, there's a very good chance they'll play one of England or Belgium in the quarterfinals. So that's a sort of a huge moment in the tournament for Germany. If they win their group, as you would expect, if they win their round of 16, as you would expect, then that's they're sort of paired up with that group at the quarterfinal stage. So that would be pretty something. I mean, whichever team it was, you know, they would be sort of monumental clashes. Yeah,
we must check in on Belgium soon. They're I don't want to say creaking, that's too strong, but over the weekend, bad friendly, Vincent Kompany injured. We were waiting for that to happen.
Jan Vertonghen had his mother present his 100th cap to him on the pitch before the game. Did you see that?
No. De Bruyne was kind of blown his cheeks in the interview afterwards, saying, yeah, look, we wanted to win, but just
is Roberto Martinez a World Cup winning manager? Can you imagine?
Yeah. No, I think is
the, there you go. You might just have to visualise that if you're going to believe in this Belgian dream.
Germany look very good again. I mean, a record qualification campaign, 10 games, 10 wins. It was flawless again. So, yeah, we'll be watching them pretty closely. And no Sané. Interesting point. He's only played 12 games. He hasn't quite translated. That just shows the embarrassment of riches that you can actually not take a chance on someone like Sané.
No, and I mean, it's not as if there's a couple of duds that they're filling out with. I mean, even Julian Brandt wouldn't be that well known. The guy who it seems like it was down to the two, but okay, he plays for Leverkusen, but he's the subject of transfer interest. In a year's time, he might end up talking. Brandt, of course. Yeah, you know, it's an Anglo-centric viewpoint, but it's still remarkable. I mean, he's still a Man City player, you know, who's excellent for them. And you would think in a tight sort of quarter final, semi final, going to extra time, say someone with his speed and attributes, you wouldn't mind having that available to you. So
yeah. We'll take a short break. We'll round off some of the last bits and pieces of news, including Yaya Toure, who thinks Pep Guardiola is against... the quote is, I don't want to misquote him. Oh, yes, he has problems with Africans, wherever he's been. So we'll bring you what Yaya has been saying next.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
So, France football get good interviews, don't they?
They get all the good stuff.
When you sit down with France football, it seems you decide to really go after it.
Well, there was that other, wasn't it, Sofoot as well, isn't it? Where Stephen Ireland sort of caused a few issues for us as well. But yes, we have Yaya Toure popping up to sort of disseminate I don't know what you want to call this, really. I mean, it's a slightly unusual interview that Traore has left Manchester City and he's decided to go to war, really, on Pep Guardiola and discuss his time working with him. He seems unhappy that he didn't get to leave Man City in the same glorious manner that the likes of Iniesta and Buffon, I think, have, you know, left or been treated with the various clubs. Now, I'm not sure if Yaya Touré will ever be have the same relationship, but I mean, his signing for Man City, it must be said, was his wages was the first thing that sprung to mind. It's not quite the same.
But what's he talking about? Sure. Because he was there on the pitch when they lifted the trophy. He was a big part of that whole trophy lifting celebration. They have named their main training pitch after him. So now when Pep and the lads go out to train, they go to the Yaya Touré pitch. Like, he's almost claiming he's been written out of history here and he's gone on the offensive. I haven't read the full interview, because I don't think it's going to be published in full until tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very interesting to get what kind of mood he's been in. But I think it's the stuff, I mean, the headlines grabbing stuff is what he has to say about Guardiola's attitude to African players.
Having problems with Africans wherever he goes. And yeah, but just some of the lines, you know, he was cruel with me. Do you believe that Barcelona could have done that with Iniesta? I even started wondering to myself whether it is about my colour. I'm not the first person to talk about his different ways of treating people. I know some other people at Barca who have also wondered about that. Maybe it's the case that we Africans aren't always treated by certain people in the same way that they treat others. He insists he has no problems with black players because he is too intelligent to be caught out.
Well, how much intelligence does it take to insist you have no problem with black players? As if, like, this is some cunning, elaborate plan from Guardiola. Yeah. He's too intelligent to admit that he has a problem with black players. I mean, that wouldn't take IQ of 180. That is an absolutely ridiculous thing to say. Yaya Touré says ridiculous things all the time. Like, he really does. And the birthday stuff. Remember the cake?
Well, like, there's another reference.
He's
to cake
not a reliable
here.
Witness here. And I, like, Yaya Touré was not good enough to play in that Man City team anymore.
When the day comes that he picks a team featuring five Africans and not naturalised Africans, I promise I will send him a cake.
But how many coaches do that across Europe?
I know. It's
outrageous.
It's outrageous, the thing to say. I mean, even if this is a section of a broader piece, it's trying to plant a seed, I think, in people's minds.
I hope Pep Guardiola sues him.
Well, yeah, I certainly imagine.
It's one of the worst things you can accuse someone of. It's completely slanderous.
No, and you think that when you plant a seed, that's the kind of thing that can, at some stage in the future, if he has some indirect dispute with an African player, that is this just that seed is planted there now that people are thinking, well maybe is there something, you know, it's certainly I don't know. He refers to people that have wondered about this before, but I mean, this is the first time that I've ever heard any sort of suggestion or insinuation or any innuendo around Pep in this department.
I know these people aren't real in a way, like Guardiola is just so famous, and you know, but imagine how upsetting that is for him and his family today. Seriously, like,
yeah, no, it's
you've just literally been called a racist in front of the whole world. We're talking about it, everyone's talking about it. There's not one example that he gives, not one example. He's just saying, like, it basically amounts to, in these quotes, I look forward to seeing the others, but I wasn't being played, and I started to wonder if it had anything to do with my colour.
Yeah, he said he likes to dominate and wants to have his obedient players kissing his hands.
I get that. We've heard that before. There's evidence of that.
It's a separate issue.
That's like what Zlatan says, where they all wanted to be, they all had to be choir boys. And it does seem that is a trait in Pep, that he does want to dominate. He wants, like, as Yaya says, players, obedient players kissing his hands. I respect my coach. That's not for me. Mm. And, you know, you read Zlatan's book and certainly Guardiola was very awkward around them and wouldn't talk to him.
Zlatan's book was a work of fiction.
Well, in places, yes. So again, that's not an overly reliable text. And Yaya, at certain points, I don't have the exact quotes here, but he talked about how around me, you know, English, Spanish and another language that they all, that basically him and Yaya could have conversed in three different languages.
Yeah.
And he said Pep just didn't ever talk to him. Mm. And that was a big complaint. But you wonder, maybe Pep's not really talking to anyone that much. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's looking at Yaya and saying, I don't want to talk to him because he's black, which is the insinuation.
Which is it's a shocking thing to just put out there.
I think so too. Now, there may be more evidence and we got to see the full interview, but it's a massive accusation.
Scarcely believable when you heard the quotes at first, but I mean, they are very much the quotes.
Well, if he stands over these, then the Manchester City HR department have to get involved and this has to be investigated. If Yaya's making these comments very seriously, then actually you think about it, then it's a massive matter. And if you're involved in that club, then Pep Guardiola has to be thoroughly investigated. And this whole thing, you need to have people called in and discuss this. This is a very serious thing to say.
Particularly when there's a serious incident, historic incidents related to events at Chelsea going on in England at the moment, going back sort of the treatment of younger players and so on. So, you don't want to be sort of speaking in flippant terms about these things, but yeah, I think Pep's response to this will probably, whenever the time comes, will put this to bed quickly.
It's weird you say that. I just did a quick last Google, so I'd say podcast listeners will have seen this already, but Pep has been asked about this. He was at a golf tournament at the PGA Catalunya de something, 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 and he said, "I'm not going to comment on those comments. I have nothing to say." I'll just see if he says anything else. Guardiola's comments come just after hours after the player's agent defended his client, rubbishing the coach's achievements and suggesting he'll never win the Champions League again because of his poor treatment of Torre. God sees everything, said the agent, as a man who acted with Yaya, the legend of the club, under different pretexts, did not give him the opportunity to go on the field. He has turned all of Africa against himself. How many African fans have turned away from Man City?
Yeah, you'd want to hear a bit more substance from Yaya here, I think.
This will be for Guardiola, an African curse. Life will show whether I'm right or not, said that agent. That's in the Manchester Evening News this evening. So, I look forward to seeing the full France Football interview and see what was going on.
I mean, this is a one person's word type event where we can't really reach firm conclusions.
No, but I know.
You would think someone would have a reputation preceding them in some way, that that this doesn't come completely out of the blue as a shock to people. So I can't imagine that might be Pep's initial response if he was doorstepped at some event, but I can't imagine it'll be his only one.
Mm. We've got a wrap. We've gone over time. I know there was
a few other things going on, but there's plenty of scandal at Aston Villa and Oldham, and clubs unravelling at a rate of knots. So they'll play out over the coming weeks, no doubt.
My thanks to you for this evening. Pleasure, Dan McDonnell in studio. You can read Dan's work as ever every day in the Irish Independent. Tom Dunn is up next. The lads from OTBAM are back tomorrow at 7:45 a.m. There's loads of texts. Apologies. There's loads of texts coming in on 2002. Which I haven't got to as well. The lads have Miola Murhurtig on the show tomorrow, which will be worth tuning in for. Facebook.com/offtheball, YouTube.com/offtheball. And we're back tomorrow, usual stuff going on. Matt Williams will join us on Wednesday Night Rugby to give us the Aussie version of events ahead of the first test this weekend. Excuse me. Thanks very much. Tom Dunn is next. Good luck.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.